This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Bill McCollum. Mr. McCollum is in Middletown, New York. I am in Lubbock, Texas. It is December 11th, 2002, about 6:10 p.m. Central Standard Time, 7:10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Mr. McCollum, why don't we start with a brief biographical sketch of yourself. Tell me where you were born and when you were born.
Okay, I was born in New York City, April 2nd, 1947.
Okay.
And my family lived in Manhattan
until
I was around 11 years old.
Wow, whereabouts in Manhattan?
178th Street.
Okay. So that's north. That's
right by the George Washington Bridge, north of the George Washington Bridge.
Okay. What was it like growing up in Manhattan there in your those very early years of your life?
Well, it was we had a neighborhood, 40, 50 kids, you know, in a two-block radius.
Mm-hmm.
We were all within 3 or 4 years of one another, and it was very exciting. There was lots of things to do. We played ball. We went down to the park and down to the river where we wasn't supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Always got caught by our parents, but it was a very peaceful neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, very little crime, and it was a very, you know, enjoyable childhood down there.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a stationary engineer in a hospital, and then he eventually went to the New York City school system,
mm-hmm.
working in the schools as the custodian.
Okay.
My mother was just a housewife, and then later on in life she started working in stores as a sales clerk.
Okay. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have two older sisters and a younger brother.
What are their ages in relevance to your age?
Okay, I'm 55, so my oldest sister is 58. The other one is 57, and my brother is 52.
So you're all relatively close in age.
Yes.
Okay. Did you have a tight family?
Very tight.
Okay. Okay. Did you work in your youth when you were there in Manhattan before you left?
Did I work in Manhattan? No.
No? Where did the family move after you turned age 11?
We moved to Yonkers.
To Yonkers, okay. And what was it like there?
It was basically the same, but now it was a little more rural with private houses instead of apartments. But
mm-hmm.
it was the same basic, you know, a lot of good people. And we did the normal childhood things, you know, playing baseball and
mm-hmm.
all the sports and didn't get involved with too much trouble.
Mm-hmm. How big was the apartment in Manhattan?
The last one we lived in, three different apartments, was three bedrooms.
Okay, there were six of you.
Yeah.
Okay, and did you share a room with one of your brothers?
Yes, my brother and I shared a room, and my sisters shared a room.
Okay, okay. So then when you moved to Yonkers, was it a lot more space for you guys?
Just a bigger room.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so my brother and I still shared a room,
mm-hmm.
but it was much bigger.
Okay. Did you attend high school there in Yonkers?
Yes, Sacred Heart High School in Yonkers.
Okay. Tell me about your high school experience. What was that like?
The school was a small parochial high school, so there wasn't much opportunity for sports, so I didn't really do much.
Mm-hmm.
Just a normal, you know, nothing out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm. What were your favorite subjects?
History and math.
Yeah.
And chemistry.
Were you particularly good in these fields, or did they just hold your interest?
When I put my mind down to it and studied, I was good at it, but... Yeah, I was a typical high school student that listening to the radio and watching television and dancing was more important than
uh-huh.
school, so.
Uh-huh. What years were you there in high school?
61 to 65.
Okay. And you mentioned watching TV and dancing. What do you remember about the outside school activities that you participated in?
Excuse me?
What do you remember about the outside activities in which you participated?
Nothing too much, really.
Yeah. Okay. Was there any military experience in your family?
My father did not serve in the military, but his brothers did.
Okay.
So I had an Uncle Jim that was in World War II and an Uncle Sonny that was in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother's brothers were all in the war, World War II, and she lost one brother.
Okay.
They were all Army.
All in the Army?
Yep.
Now, did you have much contact with your uncles who had served?
Yeah, as much as any family, but they never talked about it.
Really?
No.
You were aware that they were in the wars?
Yeah. But that was just the extent of it.
Mm-hmm. Were you curious about asking them about it, or were you told not to talk to them about it?
The subject never came up, so we just never... I didn't think much about it, to tell you the truth.
So you graduated high school in 1965.
Right.
And where did you go from there?
Well, 65 was a turning point in my life that way. That summer after high school, my father passed on.
Okay.
And so that changed any college plans I had. So I just went to a community college in Brooklyn for a year or two.
Okay.
And I tried to get into the Merchant Marine Academy. I just liked... guess from watching all the movies on television, I had liked the Navy.
Okay.
And so I tried to get into the Merchant Marine Academy and didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And then the last time I tried, which is the late 66, early 67, I said, well, if I don't make it now, I'm going to enlist in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the timing of my father passing away, life was not, I wouldn't say bad, but, you know, I wasn't happy. Didn't have a social life. I was going to school full-time and actually working full-time from 6 at night till 12 at night.
What were you doing?
I was a janitor in a high school.
Okay.
Because my father had been in the my father had been a custodian in the school systems.
Right.
So through one of his friends, I got a job.
Okay.
To help my mother, you know, because I gave her most of the money. Uh-huh. So I was going to school full-time and working full-time and never had more than $5 in my pocket. So it was just not, it's the 60s and a lot of things were changing. And I just wanted to do something different, so I joined the Navy.
How did your mother feel about that?
Well, actually, she was kind of relieved that I joined the Navy because she was worried about me being drafted into the Army.
Uh-huh.
To tell you the truth, I really never thought much about it. I thought about going into the military because, unlike today, back then, that we had the draft,
mm-hmm.
and it was a foregone conclusion that, you know, you were going to mm-hmm. be drafted, or mm-hmm. you were going to enlist.
Yes.
And, it just never gave much thought about, I was never worried about being drafted into the Army,
mm-hmm.
but when the time came, I just told my mother that, I'll join the Navy, Ma, don't worry, I won't go to Vietnam.
No.
I did tell her that.
What did she say?
She said, that's good, because she was worried that I would get drafted and...
Uh-huh.
Be sent to Vietnam.
What did your other siblings think about you joining the Navy?
They supported me. They thought, we never much talked about it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my sisters were both married at the time, so it was really only my brother and I.
Mm-hmm.
And, my brother and I didn't get along as well as we had in the past with.
Mm-hmm.
He ran around with a different crowd than I did, and he was more involved with the, smoking pot and things like that, but
mm-hmm.
so.
How would you describe yourself in 1965 and 66?
Very old.
Yeah.
I was very straight-laced.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, everyone else was at the long hair and doing all of that stuff, and I had my hair the same as I always did, and I think it's because, you know, working in the school system, you know, I always had jobs with more adults, and
mm-hmm.
you know, even though I had a lot of friends my own age, I really spent a lot of my social time with older people.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very straight-laced.
Okay. Tell me why the Navy and not the Army.
Tell you why. I was always fascinated with the Orient.
Okay.
And I always wanted to travel, you know, growing up watching shows like Route 66 on television.
Mm-hmm.
That was a life I wanted to do, you know, and I figured that the Navy offered me a better opportunity of seeing more places than, you know, being stationed in the Army. I mean, my brother-in-law and both my brother-in-laws were in the Army, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I talked to them about their experiences, you know, but they were, like, stationed in Germany for 6 months and whatnot.
Right.
I wanted the thrill of going on a cruise, you know, like to the West Pacific or the Med. And just see various different places.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured the Navy offered that
mm-hmm.
opportunity. It was worth the extra 2 years.
This was in 1966 when you joined up?
I joined up in, I think, that's another thing I, from what, reading some of those other things, where it's amazing some of these people with the dates. it was probably October 67.
Okay, October 67. So you were in the community college there in Brooklyn for a couple of years.
Yeah, and my last semester I really didn't do much, and but I just figured that I would just, you know, stop, and I'd already talked to the recruiter, and I just wanted to have was one last summer activity before, you know, I'd went away. So I made the plans to just, you know, have a good summer. I'd gotten a good summer job. In Yonkers, they had a company called Otis Elevators. They used to hire college students in the summertime. Paid them a real good salary for that time. And I had plans to enlist in October 67.
Okay. So tell me what it was like when you went to enlist, and where did you go?
Well, I went to Great Lakes to do my boot camp. And
where's that located exactly?
Great Lakes, Illinois.
Okay.
It's north of Chicago.
Is this the first time that you had traveled, gotten gone out of the New York area?
Yeah.
Okay. How was that for you?
It was an interesting experience. I mean, more so when, because boot camp was almost like school. I mean, I did join boot camp with a couple other guys, so I really wasn't, you know, completely alone. But boot camp was more like going away to school, because I spent more time in classroom than doing anything else.
In basic?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I went, after basic, I went to a Naval A school, for Engineman A school. I never done anything like that in my life. I wasn't even sure if I was going to be good with my hands, but being my father was an engineer, you know, was very good with his hands, I figured, let me try that one, you know. I did good enough in this naval test. I could, you know, get into almost any Navy school. I picked Engineman A school, but that was the, when I went back after my boot camp leave for 2 weeks, and, you know, some things always stand out in your mind, and I always remember the feeling of after I checked in back at Great Lakes. I went back to Great Lakes for A school, walking across the yard there right after going back to the barracks, and I just put my sea bag on my shoulder and said, man, this is it. You know, up until that point, it wasn't, not that it wasn't real, but it was not the same, you know, because like I said, you went boot camp in a very regimented environment, and now all of a sudden, I'm on my own, you know, walking across this, you know, drill field. And I said, wow, you really did it. You know, all the years of talking about, you know, getting out and being on your own, now you're starting. Now, that's, I'll always remember that feeling.
How did you feel at that point?
I felt great. You know, it was just, it was the changing point in my life that now I was going to have to do things differently, you know. You didn't have that comfort of home and, you know, mommy and daddy always being there, and now I was on my own.
Let's talk about your basic training just for a little bit. How long did that last? Do you remember?
Oh, let me see. About 3 months, I think.
Okay.
October, November. Yeah, 2.5 months, something like that.
Tell me kind of your basic routine there, if you remember that.
Well, we were in a big dormitory-like environment with about 88 guys. So we had 44 racks.
Okay.
Probably 22 on each side of the dorm type thing, barracks is what they call it. And it was a great cross section, you know, all different types of people, you know, obviously different racial mixtures, which was not something I was not unused to because I worked with my father in the schools a lot on summer vacations, and they were all in the South Bronx. But it was just, they were just, weren't all New York people.
Right.
From all different parts of the, mostly from the east and south, and it was a very good first exposure to a cross section of what people, you know, different peoples, not just, you know, New Yorkers. So that way it was very exciting, and I've never had any contact with any of them, but, you know, you developed a lot of friendships, and it was, for the most part, for me, it was actually easy.
Really?
I mean, like I said, after after going through almost 2 years of school, mm-hmm. full-time and working full-time, this, to me, was easy. You know, I was almost like back in school with a lot of the things. And the good thing was, as far as the, first of all, the Navy didn't have as big a, you know, the physical training like the Army or the, obviously the Marines. Mm-hmm. But we were also in a very cold environment up in the Great Lakes area. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have a lot of outdoor activities. So the physical side of it wasn't as hard as the Marines. Mm-hmm. And maybe because I was older, you know, almost 2 years older than most of the guys who were fresh out of high school, mm-hmm. a lot of the games they played, I just realized what they were playing. They were playing head games.
Right.
You know. But
these were your instructors or your fellow ensigns?
The instructors.
Okay.
You know, I've always felt that boot camp was just a mechanism of weeding out the individuals who were just not cut out for a regimented lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just the other thing about boot camp, which was hard to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think the older age and the, you know, I don't want to sound, but you know, I was a lot more mature than a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Was the fact that for the first time in most guys' lives, they were thrown in an environment where they just said, here's the rules, and here's what happens if you break the rules,
mm-hmm.
and then let you go on to your own devices.
Right.
And I was already involved in a lot of that things because my parents were, you know, they were very strong discipline. The parochial school environment was a lot the same way, and to me it was easy. A lot of the things they did to us, I just thought it was nothing.
So you were able to handle that regimented lifestyle without much problem?
Yeah, very easily.
Okay. How about the classroom aspect of it?
That also came easy. You know, I did pretty very well in most of the things.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the subjects they taught you?
Not really. You know, just you know, basic seamanship and different things like that. But
mm-hmm.
you know, the memories are also getting commingled with A school and boot camp because they came so close to one another.
Right.
And A school was nothing but a, you know, going back to school.
Uh-huh. Were any of your instructors Vietnam veterans? Had they been over to Southeast Asia?
No.
Okay.
Definitely not in boot camp.
Okay. How about in A school?
Don't remember. I know one of my classmates had been over there,
mm-hmm.
you know, on a ship because he was, he'd already been in, you know, the Navy almost a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. How old were you at that time when you got into boot camp?
I was 20.
Okay. How much contact did you have with your family during your boot camp and your A school?
Oh, boot camp, you know, just letters, you know, and a few phone calls here and there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I got to call my mother more than some people because one of the gentlemen I joined with was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And in boot camp, they encouraged you to, you know, study religion,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the Catholic and Protestant services were on the base, the boot camp side.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish services were actually on the A school side.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with Jewish services to him. Three of us went because they didn't discourage that.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to use the phones unrestricted,
oh, wow.
you know, to call home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always on a Friday night, and after services, one of the Jewish the women from different temples or different Jewish organizations always put out a spread.
Mm-hmm.
So they had, after boot camp food, great pastrami and corned beef and salami sandwiches.
Boy.
And we were, I mean, they packed enough food for 300 people, and there's
uh-huh.
probably only 30 people there.
Uh-huh.
And everyone from the boot camp side, we used to just wrap up as many sandwiches as we could stuff in our jackets. And Friday nights after we came home from services, we went back to the barracks and woke everybody up. And we always had a good feast afterwards.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's a great memory.
And I haven't thought about that in I don't know how many years.
It's interesting that that's one of your main memories there is of
yeah.
the food. What do you think was the most difficult part of your boot camp?
The loneliness.
Yeah?
Being with 88 other guys, and there were times you just felt like you were on the moon by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
In my personal life, it was good, but that was just before I joined the Navy, I was going out with a girl, so at least I had, you know, a girlfriend to write to and look forward to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd get so excited and wait for the mail, and you're almost in tears. Sometimes you did cry when you didn't get a letter that day, you know, and then, you know, next day you got three letters and you were ecstatic, and then 2 days later you didn't get any. And it was a, from those emotions were very, you know, roller coaster up and down, but, you know, everyone was going through the same thing.
How would you rate the training you received?
Adequate. You know, I, like I said, I really felt that most of it was just a indoctrination into, mm-hmm. you know, what being on your own, a maturity factor. Mm-hmm. You know, as a lot of guys probably did grow up in that time.
Now, when boot camp was ending, is that when you got to choose, after you did some testing, of where you would want it to go?
Yeah, you applied for different schools in boot camp, and then you were assigned. I got assigned to a school, and mm-hmm. you know, other guys went right to the fleet, but mm-hmm. you know, I went right to A school.
Well, tell me about A school. What was that like?
It was like I said, basically going back to school again. It was going to college, going away to college, which I didn't do. When I went to college, I commuted back and forth. So this was, you know, it was almost a little bit like a college atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I had evening classes from like 4 to 11. Mm-hmm. And I did very well, you know, because you get challenged.
And
right. The other thing about, you know, somebody said, oh, you know, I did good one test, and some, you know, some of the other upperclassmen said, oh, that were really upperclassmen, just different groups. Oh, yeah, it's easy on the first one, but you won't maintain that 90 average throughout the class. Mm-hmm. And I took the challenge, and I did. But a lot of it was stuff I had already learned in school. There was math, you know, and different things like that. And I then it was the first time I got exposed to working with my hands, because I was studying to be an engineman. Mm-hmm. And I remember one shop type class where we had to make a tool, and I did my best. I gave it to the instructor, because they weren't teachers, these were just, you know, different officers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he took one look at it and said, obviously you've never done anything like this before in your life, have you? And I said, no. You know, I went to parochial school, and he goes, you didn't have any shop in high school? And I said, no, I went to a Catholic high school where the trade schools were looked down upon. I actually used to threaten you. Well, if you didn't get good grades, you're going to go to, you know, Saunders, the trade school, like it was a demotion.
Uh-huh.
But he gave me a B on that, because he said, I know you did it by yourself, mm-hmm. and you gave it. But it was, you know, mm-hmm. it was interesting for the first time in my life to work with my hands.
Mm-hmm. How did you like that, working with your hands for the first time?
I have a job now that I'm paid to work with my brain.
Okay.
If I could get one thing out of the Navy, I could guarantee it was I wasn't cut out to work with my hands. I was always good, like, during the theory part of the class. Mm-hmm. But then when I started to take apart some of those valves and things like that, it's like, huh? And then some of these other guys who couldn't do well in the theory could take these things and put them back together again blindfold.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was, I enjoyed it.
But didn't you turn out to be an engine man?
In the Navy, yeah.
Yeah. So you must have been pretty good at this.
I was, you know, I could get by.
Okay.
You know, where the real natural mechanics, you know, they did it quicker and better, but, uh-huh. you know, I wasn't the, I deferred when, on the boat we were on, we had two engine men, and I deferred to Adam, who was a natural mechanic, and,
uh-huh.
you know, so I was more or less like his helper, and it didn't bother me in the least.
You were the thinking man's engineer.
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of weapons training did you receive in basic and then in your advanced?
Basic, I just remember shooting an M1.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until River Warfare School I did anything more than an M1 and a .45 caliber pistol, I think I remember.
Had you ever fired weapons before?
Only in the Boy Scouts.
Okay.
Fired a .22 rifle.
Okay. How far did you go in the Boy Scouts?
First class.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you could rely a little bit on that.
Yeah.
How was it? Were you good with weapons?
I was a decent shot. Mm-hmm. I could hold my own. Mm-hmm. You know, qualify as a marksman.
Okay. How long did your A school last?
Let's see. January, February, March, April, almost 4.5 months.
Okay. And this is in 1968.
This is 68.
Right. Okay. And then from there you went to your advanced training.
I got orders for Vietnam out of A school.
Did you really?
Okay. Yeah. In A school, we got orders for Vietnam.
Okay. How did you feel when you got those orders?
Shocked.
Really?
Yeah. It was like, the Navy has riverboats? You know, it was like, I didn't expect it. I really didn't expect it. I didn't expect to, you know, be thrown into that type of duty.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest thing I had to do was tell my mother that.
Mm-hmm.
But I chickened out. I told her over the phone.
How did she react?
Kind of on the stoic side. She didn't get too bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she just was normally upset, you know, worried that something would happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I didn't see much, you know, from her being, you know, just the normal concerns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have time between when you left A school before you had to report to the River Warfare School?
Yeah. In fact, I had a month off.
Okay.
Because, you know, from boot camp, they figured we were going to be, River Warfare School was going to last 2 or 3 months, and then you time off in Vietnam, so I had a month's leave before I got sent overseas. I got sent to California for River Warfare School.
Right, to Mare Island.
Right.
Naval Station. Before we get into that, tell me about when you were in school there. Did you form any formative relationships when you went through basic? I know you talked a little bit about basic, but then in advanced, in A school. Were you able to make friends?
Oh, yeah. I was, you know, I never kept contact with any of them, but
mm-hmm.
I have talked to one of them, but, we became very friendly.
Okay. What kind of engines did you work on? Were you trained to work on engines at that point or not?
Just a variety. In A school, they taught, in fact, the first part of A school was really a general for all the engineering side of the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn a little bit about the boilers, what the machinist mates learn, you know, different, you know, damage control,
mm-hmm.
Air conditioning, refrigeration, and diesel engines.
Okay.
And then that was the half of the class, and about halfway, then you split off to the specifics, and I learned more about diesel engines and, you know, valves and different things like that.
Did you have a particular area that you were more interested in than the others?
Yeah, air conditioning, refrigeration. I was never able to, you know, go any further than, you know, but that was the part I liked.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that was more like an investigative thinking side to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you had to figure, you know, things out more than, you know, just tearing apart a diesel engine. But being I never got onto a big ship,
mm-hmm.
I was never able to go, you know, that far into it.
That was going to be my next question. Did you ever get to get on one of those, the large ships that you, I guess you saw yourself on before you joined up?
Yes and no. I mean, I did get onto a ship after Vietnam, but it was an ocean-going minesweeper.
Okay.
And they weren't exactly the cream of the Blue Water Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was small and slow.
Did you know that you were going to go into riverine warfare, or is this what they were prepping you all for? Or
They prepped us, not in boot camp, not in A school.
Oh, not in A school.
You know, we knew we had heard some stories about the riverine, and nothing was like the type I wound up on.
Mm-hmm.
I actually thought from talking to the people in A school, I actually thought I was going to be wound up on PBRs.
Okay.
You know, because now I don't remember if any of the instructors had any Vietnam duty then,
mm-hmm.
but a couple of them did talk about the PBRs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had discussed it, and all of the normal scare stories. You know, like you go down a river, and every square foot of the river was the booby traps and the mortars landing, and
mm-hmm.
you know, the things like that.
Did that make you less desirable as far as getting to that kind of service, or were you said, did you look at that as a challenge and something that might be exciting?
Well, I never thought of it as a challenge. Mm-hmm. It was just something that was going to be, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was beyond my control to change it.
Right.
There was never, never in my mind any thought of doing anything but going,
okay.
you know.
Okay. So tell me about your advanced training there in California.
Okay, we go to California, Mare Island, and this was unlike, it was in some ways similar to A school, but in other ways, the base was very liberal. I mean, you know, the Navy at that time was, you know, very old-fashioned, and you know, you couldn't have civilian clothes, and, you know, in fact, that was one of the things the instructors did tell us. Don't bring any civilian clothes because you're not allowed to have them and,
mm-hmm.
you know, things like that. And one of the first things we did when we get there, they said, you can have all the civilian clothes you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
They were very lax that way. They relaxed a lot of the regulations about civilian clothes, and even the duty watches were very, we didn't do anything. You just sat around the barracks, and it was very lax.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't check up on you that much.
Okay.
Training itself was, you know, interesting. Like playing at war is fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had riverboats. We had boats, but they weren't anything like the boats we were on.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually just the old LCM-6s,
mm-hmm.
which they took those style of boats, made them into Vietnam riverboats. But at the time, I really had no idea what the boats we were going to be on looked like.
Mm-hmm.
But we trained on the weapons, and I was going to be a 50 caliber machine gunner and engineman, and we traipsed up and down the rivers and the byways around the delta areas of San Francisco and had a good old time.
Can you describe some of that training? What exactly would you do?
Well, we went on different night ops,
mm-hmm.
and you know, everyone got experience of, you know, driving the boat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and learning how to deal with the currents and, you know, land, you know, beaching the boats and dropping the ramps,
mm-hmm.
and mock firefights with the 50 caliber machine guns, you know, with the blank rounds going off and
mm-hmm.
just various things like that.
What was your impression of the 50 cal?
Awesome.
Yeah?
Awesome, to say the least.
Did you choose to get on that, or did they assign you to the 50 cal?
Everybody had a... Everybody had to take the various times out of it.
Uh-huh.
You know, everybody had to learn how to fire it, and
uh-huh.
you know, we had to learn how to disassemble it and clean it, and you know, things like that.
Right, right. Okay. You said that. Well, was there any school time? You know, classroom time, or was this more activity outside?
Mostly outside. There was the school time tended to be more just on. First aid,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the maintenance of the guns, and you know, taking them, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember anything past that.
Okay, what kind of tactics did they teach you? You mentioned going on night ops and firefights and all that. But did they teach you actually how to undergo an attack up a river, or how to perform your duties that you would be performing in Vietnam?
Yeah, but just by going up the rivers and you know, simulating firefights and things like that. Ambushes and
mm-hmm.
you know, things like that.
Well, how would they tell you to set an ambush?
They ambushed us.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, we were ambushed.
They'd send you up the river, and then they would pop out of nowhere at some point.
Yeah, and would shoot at us, and we'd shoot back, you know.
Okay. Okay. What was the most difficult thing for you there in your advanced training?
Running 5 miles on Friday.
Was that every Friday you had to do that?
Yeah. Every day we ran... just Monday to Friday. Weekends we had off, but physical training in the morning, and then we ran a mile each day, and then but Friday was the 5 miles.
Okay.
No.
How many men were with you?
Good question. I really have no memory because it was different classes.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember kind of approximately how many were in your particular class? Was it 50 or 10?
I would say closer to 50.
Okay.
Because we actually got assigned boat assignments there.
Okay.
So a few of the guys that I trained with, we went to Vietnam together.
Okay.
We went over as a class, as a group.
Okay.
At least 50, probably more.
Okay. How are you feeling, you know, when you were getting ready to leave and go over?
Normal anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reality of what war was about didn't hit you yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, up to that point, I hate to use the word fun, but, you know, when you're playing at a game, and that's all, you know, the training is a game,
mm-hmm.
you know, it comes across as fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not till you get to the real thing that you realize that, you know, in the ambushes at night, no one gets hurt,
right.
you know, in training, but then in the real world, people get hurt.
Did any of your instructors, had they been in Vietnam?
I really don't know.
Okay.
Because the Mobile River Reforce had really just started.
Mm-hmm.
So in 68, the guys who would have had that experience probably weren't coming back yet.
Mm-hmm.
So if I had to wager a guess, I would say no.
Okay. You mentioned earlier in high school that you enjoyed history. You're pretty good at history. And I'm assuming that continued through your initial military training.
Uh-huh.
How much did you keep up with world politics, world diplomacy, what the United States was doing around the world, particularly in Southeast Asia?
Just what I read in the newspapers,
mm-hmm.
things like that. But to tell you the truth, that I probably didn't read as much about it as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
I was caught up in the have a good time and party environment.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, not that I didn't know what things were going on, but, you know, I think I was in River Warfare School. Actually, I was in A School around the first Tet Offensive and the siege of Khe Sanh.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember much about them except the fact that they were happening.
Okay.
Even though, I mean, you know, I probably should have paid more attention to it,
mm-hmm.
you know. The barracks didn't have that many televisions, and I was more interested in going out and having a good time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had described yourself as kind of straight-laced.
Uh-huh.
Did you loosen up a bit when you got into A School and then to Mare Island?
Yeah. Nothing, you know, just the party atmosphere.
Uh-huh. Did you make any really good friends there at Mare Island?
Yeah, just like the guys who I went over to Vietnam with.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen a couple of them and
mm-hmm.
talked to a couple others.
Did you actually end up serving together on a boat? Or
yes, we served. We went over together and served in the same river division. A couple of us were in the same boat and others were on different boats.
Okay.
But we all were in the same river division 111.
Okay. Did you feel adequately prepared for your Vietnam experience, looking back now at your training versus what really happened?
Probably as well as they can do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's very hard to put real fear and anxiety into your training, but I would say that based on the tools they had, you know, because like I said earlier, the river training was something new even to the Navy from that point, so
mm-hmm.
you know, I can't say what the Army guys went through because, you know, they had a different type of, you know, training and they were on the ground more, but all of these tactics, especially with these type of boats, was new to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you get any time off before you had to report to go overseas?
No. I got the month off before I got to River Warfare School, but we left from California on a Friday night. I think 80% of us were hungover. And I'm sure you heard this from the other guys. You know, one of the prevailing attitudes in River Warfare School was very lax in that, what are they going to do to us, send us to Vietnam?
Yes.
And you should have heard us singing Country Joe and the Fish song on the plane going over there. And all of the older officers and whatnot were
mm-hmm.
not happy with us. But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we're on a plane bound for Saigon.
Right.
I don't think we cared.
Right.
So we sang anyway until we got tired of singing.
Yeah. What was the mood on the plane like overall?
Very jovial.
Yeah.
Very upbeat. You know. The training was over. Now you were really going.
Mm-hmm. How did it feel when you got over to Southeast Asia, being in a combat zone, did your attitude change a bit?
We went to Saigon first, so we didn't, you know, the landed in Tansanute, and we stayed in a transient barracks called the Annapolis Hotel. Down through the years, I've read many books about guys who've gone to Vietnam, Vietnam stories, and they all mentioned the smell when they first got off the plane, and I don't remember that at all.
Yeah?
No, I don't remember that at all.
What do you remember when you got off the plane?
Nothing really, just to Mahia.
Okay.
The first night was, we had to stand, watch, and I think I had the 12 to 4 watch. And I, once again, just like with when I first went to A school, that feeling in the on the field there, I'll always remember my first night in Vietnam. I remember sitting in that guard shack with a loaded M14 and looking around, and it's like, wow, you're really here. You know, up until that point, it was training and the anticipation of going, and then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, my God, you're here. You've got a flak jacket on, a helmet, and live bullets. It's not a game anymore.
Were you by yourself?
No, there was two of us.
Okay. Was the other person new as well?
Yeah. We were all new.
You guys were talking about actually being there.
Yeah. Yeah.
What other weapons did you train on besides the 50 cal? Apparently the M14.
Mostly the M14, a lot on the 50, a little bit on the 20, and the 40 millimeter pom poms. Those are the three guns we're going to have on the post, but mostly the 50.
Which did you prefer?
The 50. The 40, I wasn't going to one of those mic boats, and the 20s jammed too much.
Okay.
The 20s had a bad reputation of jamming. And I wanted to have something that wasn't going to jam.
Right, of course.
So.
Now, when you had arrived there in Saigon, did you understand or know what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
Yes, I did. I supported what we were doing in Vietnam from day one that I can remember. I've read in high school many numerous books about communism. My two favorite subjects of books I read in high school were Nazism and communism, and I should say World War II in general.
Okay.
And not that there was any, you know, appeal for it on my part, but just because it was going on in the world. And I believed in the domino theory, and I felt that we had to do it. You know, it wasn't popular, and obviously the way they were fighting it wasn't necessarily the best way. But it was a stand I felt we had to take.
Okay.
Did you ever see the movie Pork Chop Hill?
Yes, sir.
You know, that's the philosophy. You know, will we fight? And I will tell this to everybody except the mother of a boy killed in Vietnam, that we had to fight, because us fighting over there in the long run prevented potentially a nuclear holocaust. That if you give in to the bullies, you know, something really worse can happen.
Right.
And if we didn't put out these little brush fires, and that was one of the things that I resented about the media, is that they never told the whole story. I mean, if you listen to some of the things that went on back then, you would have just thought it was big, bad American military picking on this poor, third-rate country. You know, but they never had much mention of where they got their weapons from, where they got the sophistications for putting missiles and all of those things in Hanoi, that it was the most dangerous place to fly in the world, that there was a whole other side that was fighting us. You know, it wasn't just us against, the North Vietnamese. And I believed in what we did, and I really think we made the world a better place for doing it.
Okay, okay. So when you were there in Saigon, you were thinking basically the same thing. That
yes.
You needed to be there.
Uh-huh.
The United States needed to be there.
Right.
Okay. If you would, tell me what happened there in Saigon, your first few days, your first week.
Well, within a couple of days, we were sent down to the to Dong Tam, the 9th Infantry Base there, and we reported for the riverboats. Because we relieved crews and never saw them, but, you know, we just went, within a couple of days, we were on the river.
Okay. Was that too fast, or were you ready for this?
No, we were ready. I don't think there was anything more that we needed to do at that point. For just, you know, we had spent 3.5 months of getting ready for this, and now we were there.
Okay. Can you tell me what your living quarters was like there at Dong Tam?
Well, Dong Tam, for a day or two, we did spend in some hooches that, you know, probably not much bigger than a normal living room with about 10 racks in it.
Okay.
And we slept there a couple of days just to get indoctrinated, and you know, I guess they think they might have given us a few more shots or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went right out to the riverboats.
Okay. Where did you, what was your base camp like there? I mean, did you have, after this initial housing that you just described, where did you live from there on out?
On the riverboat.
On the riverboat itself.
Yeah, we had each time the, okay, maybe the best way to describe it is, we had different periods of activity.
Mm-hmm.
The worst one being the line period. So we would tie up the river, the whole river division then would be tied up to one of the barracks boats.
Okay.
So then we would be close enough to pick up the army troops.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we did hash and trash, which was just different things. Sometimes we escorted the artillery barges.
Mm-hmm.
Our sister division, 112, if they had a big operation, they might take one or two boats from us. We'd be on a different ship.
Right.
And then the final one was the base security, where the boats were constantly, you know, going around the ships. 24 hours a day, there was always boats, you know, protecting the ships.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd tie up to a different type of ship.
Okay.
So we always had a rack on board the ship,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of times it was easier just to sleep on the boat.
Okay.
We had racks and our, you know, lockers on the boat.
Why don't you go ahead and describe the boat itself?
Excuse me. Okay, I was on one of the ATCs, Armored Troop Carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I don't know, not very good at the description of the length, but it's probably no more than 60 feet long.
Okay.
And it was just a big well deck.
Okay.
And then in the back of the well deck, they had racks.
Mm-hmm.
And they had four racks back there. And we had a string up racks from the rafters. The boats had canopies.
Mm-hmm.
So I had one of the racks up by the rafters. I figured it might be a little cooler up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the back part was the engine room. And above the engine room, above the living space there, was the coxswain's flat, and they had built the gun mounts back there. The boat had triple gun mounts in the back with a 20 caliber in the center and 250s on either side, 20 millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And in the front of the boat, by the ramp, they had 250s.
Okay.
We had 230 calibers towards the back of the boat, but they never worked.
Okay.
And I was doing operations. I was the 50 caliber on the port side in the well deck. So when I went down, when we went down the rivers, I was always down there with the Army guys.
Mm-hmm. How many decks was the boat itself?
Really only one big deck.
Okay.
But in the back, you could go up to a different level for the coxswain's flat and the gun mounts.
Okay, okay. And when you would pick up troops, they would just basically gather there.
They would, yeah, they would climb. We had seats. They actually had seats in there for them to sit on.
How many troops could you carry?
About 40, which is, I think, the size of a platoon.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think the way they designed it, We could actually carry more, I mean, if you wanted to fill them up.
Right.
But they always wanted to make sure if one boat broke down,
mm-hmm.
that we could very easily pick up another boat's troops
mm-hmm.
without overcrowding.
Right, right. And what kind of speed would this boat go to?
With the current, about 5 knots maybe.
Uh-huh.
They were extremely heavy. They had like 40, about 60 tons, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of armor plating on them. And the boats were very heavy, very slow.
Mm-hmm. Were they loud?
Pretty much, yeah. They knew when we were coming.
Okay.
They had two diesel engines, General Motors 6-cylinder engines,
mm-hmm.
and twin screws. So they were pretty loud.
Where did you get your food? Did you eat there on the boat?
We carried sea rations on board the boat.
Okay.
We always had 50, 60 cases of sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
The some of it was the front of the coxswain's flat had this bar armor
mm-hmm.
and a space, the bar armor being to detonate the rockets
mm-hmm.
prematurely so the shrapnel would, you know, not go through as easily.
Mm-hmm.
And we always, that's where we stored our sea rations, as an extra minuscule protection against the rockets and just a place to put them.
Right, right.
And we always bartered our sea rations for whatever we needed. You needed a case of beer,
mm-hmm.
you used a case of sea rations. You got a case of Coke, bottle of Jim Beam, ice, female companionship.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we used the sea rations for.
Was there a lot of bartering that went on?
Oh, yeah.
And it was readily easily to do?
Yes.
Okay.
Because right near Dong Tam, I mean, it was a small village there, and the people always coming out and coming with the sampans to sell us things. No matter where we went, unless it was a very hot area, there was always kids and people around and trying to sell us things.
Did you feel like you had enough supplies there in the field?
Oh, yeah. We had plenty of ammunition, plenty of water, as much of the sea rations if you want. The only thing we were lacking was the heat tabs to heat the sea rations. So we used to use plastic explosives. We were always making deals with some of the Army guys. I didn't smoke, so anytime I got my hands on cigarettes, I always kept them, so I can always use some cigarettes to trade one of the Army guys to get a couple sticks of C4
mm-hmm.
or a couple Claymore mines and take them apart. And
mm-hmm.
That's what we used to use to heat our sea rations.
How would you do that?
Well, plastic explosives don't explode unless they're under compression and a very sharp, strong electric spark.
Mm-hmm.
So you would just pull off a piece the size of a large marble
mm-hmm.
and you would light it with a match.
Hmm.
And it would burn very hot. And you would take one of the empty cans of sea rations, you'd make like a little stove.
Mm-hmm.
Punch a couple holes in it, and that's what you would use.
Hmm. And you could do this right there on board?
Yeah, the deck, the metal, the bottom of the deck of the boat was metal.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just do it right there on the deck there.
Okay. That's interesting. What were the most favorite things that you guys would try to get?
Beans
for?
And Franks.
Beans and Franks?
Yeah.
Sea
ham
ration?
And eggs weren't too bad.
Sea ration beans and Franks?
Sea rations, beans and Franks, yeah.
Okay. And ham and eggs?
Yep.
Okay. And what were the things that you would try to get when you were bartering for outside things? You mentioned a case of beer, Jim Beam, women. What were the things that you really tried to go after?
The women.
Tell me how that worked.
The girls would come around and, depending on whether the boat captain wasn't around, you let them on the boat, or if we were able to, if the area was secure enough, we might walk off into the bushes with them.
Were you ever worried that these might be Viet Cong?
You worried about it for about 5 seconds when they came around.
Okay.
The normal male genes took over.
Okay, okay. And
I mean, we heard all the rumors, this and that and the other thing, but, the boats used to just sit there. If they were going to shoot at us, they didn't have to have the women to come up to us. They could have just shot at us right from the riverbank.
Right. Now, did this happen mainly when you were back tied up toward the mouth of the river, or back toward Dong Tam, or was this pretty much wherever you went?
Wherever we went. Well, okay, on a normal operation, we would pick up the troops. We just go down this river or canal, you know. I really never had much. I was not involved in driving the boats. I never really paid much attention to where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And we would drop the troops off. Mm-hmm. And the plan was that they would sweep an area, and we would go down river for 3 or 4 miles, whatever it took, and wait for them.
Okay.
In fact, I went to one of these reunions, not this one, the couple years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I was actually talking to one of the 9th Infantry guys, and I said that to him. He says, "You guys stayed out there with us?" I said, "Yeah, where do you think we went?" He goes, "I don't know. I thought you guys went back to the ship."
Huh.
I said, no, man. We just went down the river 3 or 4 miles, but that was also for their protection.
Right.
So we could make a quick extraction because, like I said, the boats weren't fast. So even though we weren't going that far, it sometimes took a couple hours to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed in close proximity so that we could be there. You know, we go down the river 20 boats strong, 20, 25 boats strong. You talk about 75, 50 caliber machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
So we could put out a lot of firepower and their protection and extract them.
Mm-hmm.
But we were always near some village or whatnot, and they knew we were there, so they would all come out. You know, the kids would be the first to come out.
Right.
You know, they would hang around and, you know, talk to us. And then the people would, you know, come out with the boats and have the beer and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And then girls would come around.
What was your impression of the Vietnamese people?
I thought they were very nice. I don't like to use the word sorry because, you know, not that we're above them.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt deeply sorrowful for them that, especially the kids, that they had known nothing but war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, well, get down. Stop. Hold on a second. Get down from there. You know, World War II had just ended, and then, you know, the fighting with the French and then the fighting with us. I mean, this was a whole generation that knew nothing but a war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the kids were the worst to look at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they were the ones that hurt the most, I think. But as a rule, I thought they were very pleasant, very friendly people.
Did you ever try to learn Vietnamese?
No, not really, because we really didn't have enough full contact with them, except in, you know, in fact, the thing was most of them knew American slang anyway, so
mm-hmm.
it was easier because they could talk to us.
Mm-hmm. How many boats you said would go down the river on a typical mission?
25, sometimes a couple more.
And how many of the ATCs would go?
Oh, sometimes a whole contingent. We had 13 in the river division.
Mm-hmm.
So all 13 would be going down the river, sometimes more, depending on the size of the operation.
Okay. What was your particular job on the boat?
Well, during battle stations, excuse me, I was a 50 caliber machine gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I was the second engineman. You know, we had a radio man, a couple other guys were gunner's mates,
mm-hmm.
and we had two engine men, so, you know, we just had to keep the engines going. And
okay. So when you would go down the river, would you be on the 50 cal, or would you be hanging back with the engines?
On the 50 caliber.
Okay. Okay, so when you tied up back at the barracks ship, that's when you would work on the engines or do whatever repairs were necessary.
Right.
Were these boats reliable? Were there a lot of repairs involved?
Pretty reliable. I mean, like any machinery, I mean, you're going to have their breakdowns, and
mm-hmm.
you know, but it, I would say they were fairly reliable. I remember enough times you went down the river that a boat broke down or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
it wasn't a common thing, you know.
What happened when a boat would break down when you were in the middle of a mission?
I was lucky enough to never have seen it happen with any of the boats I was with doing any firefights,
mm-hmm.
but just in a normal operation, you would just tie up to another boat. Another boat would come alongside you. We'd tie up the ropes and we'd tow them.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
No, the other thing is an engineman, what we had to do, these, I'm sure you see the pictures of those boats where the ramps used to just drop down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Now, they had a wench in the engine room to connected, it was a belt that connected the wench to the port engine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the time we got there, like I said, there was already a whole year's crew, and they had learned the hard way that those coxswains flat where the wench was, they were very small,
mm-hmm.
and they found that it was very common to hit that lever
mm-hmm.
and partially engage the wench. So at the worst possible times during a couple of firefights or just troop extractions, they found out that the clutch was burnt out on the wenches.
Okay.
So when we went down the river and we weren't getting ready to do any dropping of the ramp,
mm-hmm.
we did not have the belt on the engine.
Mm-hmm.
And against all safety regulations, we had to put that belt on the ramp with the engine running, standing off to the side with a ball peen hammer,
uh-huh.
you know, and every once in a while missing and watching the hammer go flying across the engine room. So right before we were going to have to drop the ramp, one of us would have to go back to the engine room and put the belt on.
Uh-huh.
And that's the first firefight I was ever in. I was the one that was going back.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that I've always felt that they don't show in TV or movies enough is what these Army troops really take in the field with them.
Mm-hmm.
Until you've been on a boat, or even close to them, you see what they hump off the mm-hmm. boat with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to the back of the engine room, and by then they were all standing up and trying to get their racks and packs, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like on a crowded subway train,
mm-hmm.
you know, pushing my way down. And I get to the edge of the engine room door, and I open it up, and I turn back to look, and I couldn't see the other engine men up at the other 50, because all of the Army guys were standing.
Mm-hmm.
And as I turned to go into the engine room, that's when the rockets first went off.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked back, all I could see was Adam at the front of the boat.
Mm-hmm.
All the Army guys hit the deck.
Oh, wow.
Every one of them, this was their first time on the boats also.
Uh-huh.
Maybe there was a couple of the sergeants. So they didn't know what to expect either.
Mm-hmm.
So they were down there kissing the deck. And the training takes over. The only thought I had was I had to get to my gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I just crawled over them, you know, and ran up to the front of the boat
mm-hmm.
and started shooting.
This is your first experience with combat?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know.
Did you know what you were shooting at?
No. I mean, it was just, we heard some rockets. You could actually hear them whooshing and
uh-huh.
just over the radio. I don't even remember what position we were.
Uh-huh.
It's just that all of a sudden you heard all of the guns open up.
Uh-huh.
You know, because the order came down to open fire. And that's all I remember is that I heard all the commotion and ran up to the front of the boat. You know, of course I had a good laugh with those guys when they came back on about them kissing the deck. But
uh-huh.
by our second firefight, they were all on the edge of the boat with their guns and their M60s firing back. Because the first shock factor being fired upon on one of the boats was gone now, and they were,
uh-huh.
you know, prepared to shoot back with us.
Did you carry the same troops, basically?
Sometimes. You know, not always, you know, dependent on the operation.
Uh-huh.
You know, sometimes they got rotated. To this day, I know, like, they were the 3rd and the 60th and the 4th and the 40th. But back in those days, I just knew they were 9th Infantry.
Right.
You know, and sometimes I did see the same guys that we, you know, picked up and we'd take them back, to, you know, a few days later.
Right. Was your first firefight, was that daytime or nighttime?
Daytime.
Okay.
I was only involved in one nighttime firefight.
Why don't you go ahead and describe that?
All right. The nighttime firefight was the River Division had moved up near the Cambodian border,
uh-huh.
and we were operating with some Green Berets. And one evening, we got the orders with just my boat and another boat. We had to take some troops back to this smaller outpost.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't even 9th Infantry. They were 1st Cavalry. I mean, not the Big Red One,
okay.
not the 1st Cavalry.
Okay. The 1st Army Division.
Yeah, and they had a small outpost, the middle of nowhere, just way down this. That's the other thing about the Mekong Delta. Unbelievably flat. You know, not like up in the Khe Sanh area and up in, you know, the northern part. The Mekong is, it's like as far as you can see. Mm-hmm. So we're just going down, down. All of a sudden, this outpost was there. And it was right at dusk now. And normally we would have gone back, but they told us they didn't want us to go back at night unprotected. Mm-hmm. Plus, the intelligence was that Charlie was going to hit that outpost that night. And they wanted us there as a surprise to the Viet Cong. And so we were like 20, 30 yards down from the base. You know, one boat was banked on one side of the canal. We were banked on the other. Don't remember what time of night it hit, but they did hit. Mm-hmm. And they didn't expect us to be there. And that was probably the longest firefight ever. Probably the first phase of the firefight probably lasted about 20 minutes. You know, and if there was a night, I don't know if I killed anybody. Mm-hmm. But if there was a firefight, that if it did happen, it was probably that one. Mm-hmm. Because being it was at night, you could see where they were firing from. Mm-hmm. You know, you could see the flashes of the guns, the AK-47s when they fired at us. Mm-hmm. And even when they fired the rockets, you could see the trail as soon as they fired them. Mm-hmm. So we were able to concentrate our fire. The whole thing probably lasted well over an hour, but after the first 20 minutes, it was just some sporadic shooting by the, you know, the Viet Cong trying to get us to shoot at the base and the base to shoot at us, because mm-hmm. you could actually see from where they were shooting from that they were moving in a more parallel, hoping that they would shoot and duck, and then we would, you know, shoot at the base.
Had you landed the troopers that you were carrying?
Yeah, we did that before dusk.
Okay.
Before dark.
And then you went and parked the boats and waited?
Yeah, and then we waited.
Were you on alert all night, or did you go in shifts?
We were on alert
okay.
all night.
Okay. Do you remember, you said you could see where they were firing from. And
yeah.
You said they were firing AKs and rockets. What other weapons did the enemy use?
That's all that I know they used on us.
Okay. How well protected were you on your 50 cal? Besides having the actual rounds firing off.
Really? And not, I mean, maybe there was like little shield, mm-hmm. maybe 12 inches to either side of the 50.
Right.
Looking at it back of today, it wasn't much protection. Mm-hmm. The gun mounts in the back, they had more protection because they were enclosed and just had a slit that they were able to fire from. But the gun mounts up front, we were fairly exposed from the upper chest up.
Wow. Do you remember thinking during the firefight, or were you just reacting?
During the firefight, you never thought. You just reacted.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was the before and after. You know, the adrenaline rush that took place during the firefight, you didn't worry about it. You just fired.
Mm-hmm. And what did you feel before, and what did you feel after?
Before, extreme anxiety. You know, like, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. And then afterwards, just a total relief that nothing happened.
Right.
You know. Unless a round cooked off and then felt like someone stuck a hot poker up your butt. The 50 caliber machine guns got hot.
Uh-huh.
They actually, I've seen my gun barrel red. That's how hot it would get.
Wow.
You know, and of course there was no touching that afterwards. I found out that some boats had asbestos gloves for, you know, changing them. We never had them on our boat, mm-hmm. so we didn't touch them. So you couldn't even touch the breech to open it up. So there was always a round in the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
So after a firefight, you always pointed the gun up in the air. Because you never know when one was going to cook off.
Right.
But the good thing was, when it cooked off, only one went off. It didn't fire as a, you know, machine gun.
Right.
But boy, that was one of the. Because, like I said, your body is just relaxing, and you're saying, "Oh my God, it's over!" And then this gun goes off, and it's like, "Oh."
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't happen that often.
Did you ever worry about when you guys were tied up on the bank? Anybody trying to come on board your ship?
No.
Why not?
There was always somebody on watch.
Okay.
So it was, you know, like, even though we were doing nothing, there was always at least two people. You know, we always had two men alert. And I just never worried about it.
What was your crew? How many men were on board with you?
Okay, there was three gunners up front, which made the guy driving the boat was four.
Mm-hmm.
Two in the front of the boat is six, and the boat captain, seven.
Okay. Pretty light crew.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you ever notice any tension between the draftees, people who had been drafted, versus those who were careerists?
Not really.
No?
No.
Did you ever hear any discussion or witness or hear about incidents of fragging?
I've heard the stories. Never any anybody saying that they did it.
Right. Nobody, the stories you heard, were they within your task force? Yours?
No.
Okay.
Not with the 9th Infantry.
Okay. How would you rate the enemy? You came in contact with him a few times, I would guess. And what would you say, first, your general impressions of the NVA or the Viet Cong?
Extremely courageous. The firepower that the American military put out on these people was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I said, the boats going down the river on one bank, we had 50 caliber machine guns going off.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always helicopters in the area. And we had the 20s were going off, maybe 10, 15 20s. We put out an enormous amount of firepower, which is also why they didn't stand and fight toe-to-toe as much as the American military command would probably have liked, because it was suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they relied on ambush. You know, generally most of the situations where I heard of people getting hurt was the first part of the ambush. Because by that time, you know, these guys were not going to be standing up firing the rockets at us that easily with that much firepower coming at them.
Right.
But I had the greatest respect for them. I think that they were extremely courageous, dedicated group of men.
Could you ever tell that whether they were Viet Cong or NVA regulars?
I never saw any of them. I only saw a couple captions, and they were definitely Viet Cong.
Okay.
But, you know, who actually were fighting at us, I, you know, was never aware of who they were.
How could you tell this guy was Viet Cong?
Well, he didn't have he had, like, just normal clothes on.
Okay. Okay. What would you say were the enemy's strengths?
Well, their ambush ability and their ability to pick when and where they wanted to hit us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was their greatest. And the ability to escape, you know, based on the tunnel complex. And I did get a chance to see a couple of the bunkers that they had built along the sides of these canals and rivers, and there was, like, you know, 3 or 4 feet of dirt and, you know, metal sheet in the middle of it, and it's just extremely, extremely strong-looking. That, you know, I can understand how that when we shot at them, we didn't always hit them.
How about his weaknesses?
His weakness? Well, from a military perspective, they just couldn't put the firepower back out at us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to rely on numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, on the rivers, they really didn't hit us in any great numbers.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever wounded?
No.
Tell me about your first experience with death, with American casualties.
That would have to be Halloween night, 1968. The ship we were tied up to, well, actually it turned into November 1st. It was about 3:25 in the morning. They put two mines on the side of the Westchester County.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
where were you? You were
3 or 4 boats out.
Were you on watch that night?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was semi-awake. You ever been on watch at 3:30 in the morning?
No, I've been doing other things at 3:30 in the morning, but not on military watch.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, you're awake, but you're not awake.
Uh-huh, right.
You know? But, no, I was sitting on the edge of the boat, just listening to the radio. Always had the radio on.
The military net, or were you listening to Armed Forces Radio?
Armed Forces Radio.
Okay.
No. If we were out on operation somewhere, we always had the, but then we had our radios on. And just saying, oh, it's about 25 more minutes, I can go wake up my relief and get to bed. And mm-hmm. That's when it hit.
What happened?
I thought I was dead. I thought I was dead, and I was watching it happen. Mm. This huge blast and explosion. Truthfully, I can't even remember if I can say it was a bright light. Mm-hmm. I just, you know. And the funny thing, it's not funny, but when it first happened, mm-hmm. I thought it was an explosion on the ship. I thought one of the boilers went off. Mm-hmm. One of the big boilers went off. And I said, wait a minute, they don't have big boilers on one of these ships. Mm-hmm. You know. But, all of the stuff, it must have been light enough because I could see stuff going up in the air. You know, I'm just actually laying back on the canopy saying, oh my God, you're dying, and you're watching it happen. And all the stuff came down, and it's like, oh my God, you're alive. Nothing happened.
About how far away were you? You said four boats. You talking about 100 yards? Or?
No, I would say maybe 25 yards.
Oh, okay. And did you see the American casualties?
No, I didn't see any of them. But, you know.
26 were killed, if I remember correctly. Yeah, okay. Was that your first and only experience with such an incident, or with the death of American troops?
Not the only. There was, I could feel I did get to see some of the Army guys. They became friendly with a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. enough of the Army guys, and, you know, periodically, you know, where's Joe, and, oh, didn't you hear, and no, and I knew what they meant, and, mm-hmm. you know, took a sniper shot in the head. So there was a few incidents like that. Excuse me. And then the, I wasn't on the boat the night my boat got hit. In March of 68, we were also up in a place called Muc Hoa. And that's the Vietnamese place. The other place we were at was a Green Beret base. But at Muc Hoa, I was taken off the boat and put on a radio watch.
Is this March in 69?
Or? Yes.
Okay, 69. Okay. Go ahead.
And the biggest reason... my boat captain and I had a strained relationship. Mm-hmm. Just normal, you know. I was from New York, so I was a bum.
Okay.
You know, so.
And where was he from?
He was from Ohio, but he spent a lot of time down south in the military. But mm-hmm. he thought all New Yorkers were bums. He told us mm-hmm. enough times. I mean, I didn't do too much to, you know, make him think otherwise, but he had an opportunity to get me off the boat, so I stood a radio watch for about a week. Mm-hmm. You know, I was an engineman, so I really, you know, not that I had no business, but I wasn't qualified to stand a radio watch.
Right.
I complained to our division commander, and he said, okay, get me back on the boat, and we were getting ready to go out that night. And I was cleaning my 50. And it was like 20 minutes before they went out, and he came over to me and pulled me aside and said, Mac, I know, you know, told you I put you on the boat, but please do me a favor. The guy who you know, was supposed to relieve you is sick. Would you stand and watch one more night? You know, what can I say? You know, he was nice enough not to, you know, to treat me as a, you know, not an equal, but, you know. Anyway, I stood the watch, mm-hmm. and the boat got hit that night.
What happened?
They took two rockets. They were going... That was another night op, but mm-hmm. they... one of the Mike boats, I don't know how many rockets they took. They took quite a few also. Mm-hmm. But on my boat, one guy was... who I trained in California with and went over there with, he was killed. An Army lieutenant was killed. And three other guys, actually, my boat captain included, was medevaced out, including the guy who was where I should have been.
Really? On the port 50 cal?
Yeah, he was hit from shrapnel from the two rockets. One hit the front of the boat on the ramp, and the other one hit right near where the coxswain's flat is. So he was more or less hit by two of them. Mm-hmm. And I don't ever know what happened to him. You know, he survived, but you know, that was one of the things that they didn't tell you. In other words, someone would get hurt and sent out, and they never thought enough to bring people up to date that, you know, so-and-so was all right or whatever, unless he came back.
Did you guys have a problem with that?
It was just the way it was, so we didn't think much of it. Mm-hmm. You know.
How did you feel when you heard this news and you got back on board?
I knew it when it was happening because I was on the radio watch.
Okay.
I felt extremely upset. You know, I continued doing what I was supposed to, but then, you know, they knew what happened and they came and relieved me. Mm-hmm. And I sat outside the Radio Shack and cried for an hour.
Did you know that your friend had been killed?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was hit by the heat round.
Mm-hmm.
So he never felt a thing. That I didn't find out till a reunion a couple of years ago. I just thought he was hit by shrapnel.
Right.
But I finally went to one of the reunions where I met a couple of the guys I was over there with.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I knew that I met them afterwards, mm-hmm. after I got back from Vietnam and we went to sea school together, we never talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked about it that night, and he was hit by the heat round, so he never felt a thing. And that's when I found out that the Army lieutenant had, you know, died from the wounds.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, whoever was supposed to turn the gun skyward did not.
What do you mean, turn the
gun? Well, it's turn the gun, the 50 cal. It was a heat round, the one that went off after?
No, the heat round was from the rockets.
Oh.
The rockets they fired at us had heat rounds in them.
Oh, okay, okay. So he was hit by the rocket.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, the rockets detonated and shrapnel, you know, exploded all in the area, but they were armor-piercing heat rounds because they knew they were shooting at these big boats with the armor-piercing. And that just thing goes right through the metal.
Yeah. Did you ever have any problems with your weapons functioning incorrectly? You talked about the 30 cal, but...
No, the 50s were probably the most reliable gun in the world.
Yeah.
The 30s, the trouble with the 30s was we didn't have 30 caliber ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
We had 7.62 rounds, and it's one of those, you know... Hypothetically, they should work,
mm-hmm.
and they do work, but they had a tendency to jam.
Okay.
You know, and so we just never bothered using them. Plus, as it actually, you know, turned out, we had more guns on the boat than we had people.
Right.
So we had five people manning the guns and one driving.
Uh-huh.
So that just left the 230s, you know, decorations in the back of the boat.
Mm-hmm. Were there any weapons that you wish you had but did not have?
No. We had 12-gauge shotguns, sawed-off barrels.
Mm-hmm.
We used to use them to shoot the crap in the water because there were times they used to put floating mine devices and like the clumps of weeds, you know, hoping to get lucky and
mm-hmm.
blow up a boat. So we were able to shoot anything in the water like that. And we had percussion hand grenades to throw in the water,
mm-hmm.
you know, for divers. We missed the divers the night of Halloween, but...
Mm-hmm. Did you encounter a lot of the floating mines in the rivers?
No, we never encountered any of them. Shot at things, but nothing ever detonated.
Okay. How much contact did you have with home while you were over there?
Just letters.
Yeah?
And I just talked to my mother when I went on R&R.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to call her for Thailand.
Okay.
Twice.
How were those conversations with her?
Very pleasing, you know, but on both sides. She was very happy to hear that everything was all right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things, there's a memorial in Lower Manhattan, and it has letters from soldiers from Vietnam. My mother could not put my letters on the wall, because I never told my mother anything. My mother worked in a stationery store in Yonkers. It was owned by two brothers. And I was friends with the brothers before they became my mother's boss, and I used to go out with one of them. You know, he was single. We used to go out, drink on Friday, Saturday nights, and I would help him in the store. He said to me right before I got shipped out to River Warfare School, he said, "Bill, you know, all the years I've known you, I've never tried to tell you anything. Because as a dumb kid, you would never pay any attention." He said, "But you got to pay attention to this one. Don't write your mother anything about what you're doing and how you're feeling. Because it's going to be bad enough on her that you're over there. Don't make it worse by telling her about it." So I never told my mother anything. I used to write her la-la letters. "Hi, Ma. It's hot. We dropped off the troops. I'm sitting here reading a book. It's hot. The food is lousy. I'm fine. I hope you're doing all right. Bye." So I didn't have to, burden her with. So same thing applied when I got to R&R. You know, it's just, "Hi, Ma. Send me some money."
So you watered it down as well.
Yes.
Calls.
You know. Plus, by then, I was in Thailand having the greatest time of my life, and the last thing I wanted to do is, you know, think about going back there.
Did you end up telling your mother later what you
did? Oh, yeah. I told her the night I got home, and she turned white as a ghost.
Tell me about your R&Rs that you mentioned. How many did you go on?
I went on two.
Where did you go?
I went to Bangkok both times.
Okay. How was Bangkok?
Oh, well, you know what they called R&R.
Yes.
It was, the Thai people were fabulous. They were all friendly. They all came across as welcome to my country. I took as many sightseeing trips in Bangkok as I could. You know, the time spent with the girls was wonderful, but that wasn't the only thing. I mean, now I was finally doing what I had joined the Navy to do, you know, visit a foreign country, and I had a ball. I didn't drink as much as, you know, some of them did, because I didn't want to waste my time being drunk.
So, how long were they?
5 days.
Were you able to go with some of your buddies?
If you had set up to go, but from the time we got to Vietnam, we had heard rumors about us turning over our river boats to the South Vietnamese Navy and us going home early, so a lot of the guys that I went over there with didn't bother taking R&R.
Okay.
We had to be in country 5 months, 5.5 months, and I put in for R&R as early as I could. I wasn't going to waste an opportunity to go visit an exotic land. The second R&R I took from Da Nang, because it did come to pass that we turned over the boats, and they changed their mind. In 1969, the first troops Nixon sent home were Marines and 9th Infantry troops, and the 9th Infantry troops had our flights.
Okay.
So we got shuffled around, and we actually got sent to Da Nang. That unto itself wasn't too bad, because once I got to Da Nang and realized that the rumors that the sky fell every night there and it was so dangerous was not true, and coming off of a frontline combat unit going to a rear support facility was second best besides going home. And I got a second R&R out of it, because I put in for R&R and didn't tell the division commander that I took it. He asked me, "Didn't you take R&R when you were down south?" And I told the truth. I just didn't tell the whole truth. I said, "Sir, when we thought we were going home early, a lot of guys did not take R&R. And that was the gospel truth."
Right.
I just didn't tell him I was one of six that did. So he put in a second R&R. I went back to Bangkok only because when I got to the R&R center, they had two flights leaving the next day. One of them was Bangkok, and one of them was Kuala Lumpur, and I picked Bangkok. On that trip, I got, because now I'm the old established veteran, and I was talking with, you know, sitting on the plane with some Marines who were going on their first R&R, and I knew all of the things to do.
Right.
So on that one, I got to, you know, pal around with, a, you know, three or four Marines, and one in particular that we did a lot of things together. So.
Did you feel recharged once you got back in country?
Oh, yes. Ecstatically. It was like you were in a walking dream for a few days afterwards.
Tell me what your duties were in Da Nang.
I worked at a small support facility where we rebuilt two-cylinder diesel engines.
Okay.
So.
And that was it?
That was it. That's all
and
I did all day.
Were they for ATCs or?
No, they had. They were different things. Some of them were just for generators and small things. And
okay.
Actually, we didn't even know what they were used for. We just got the engine would come in broken and, you know, with the piston blown or something like that, and we just fixed it and put it back on the truck as done, and they would take it wherever they brought it from.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with a Filipino guy there.
Yeah.
He was a very good engineman.
You mentioned that you kind of got to know the troops a little bit that you carried up and down the river.
Uh-huh.
How much did you mingle with them when you were on the mission?
On the mission only as we were going down the river.
Mm-hmm.
Once they left the boat, we had no contact with them until they came back on. When we were in a downtime, I mingled with them a lot on the ships, you know, watching television, having a few drinks, playing cards with them. They used to come off the boat, and there was quite a few guys from New York who were in the Army there, and they were predominantly black and Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And I would talk to them because we had a common bond. We were both from New York. And so I was one of the few white guys they would invite into their compartments to get drunk.
Uh-huh.
So I had a lot of contact with them on the ships.
Did you ever encounter any race issues?
Not drastic. You know, just the normal.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing of any, not too many race issues in the frontline units.
Mm-hmm. What would you guys do for entertainment?
Watch television, drink, and play cards.
Yeah?
And tell stories about all the girls you had at home and all the things you were going to do and what you were going to do when you got back to the world.
What kind of drug and alcohol use did you witness?
I saw some guys smoke pot.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some Army guys, the after effects of them when they were smoking pot and the drinking. I've never seen them, any of them, either the drinking or the marijuana, during an operation or right before.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only time it was, and it happened to be that we were operating down there, actually near the sea,
mm-hmm.
and we were supposed to be in a down status. So technically, when we went into down status, we weren't going to move unless something critical happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we pounded back a few.
Right.
And you live in Texas, you know, it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to drink a lot to get, you know, kind of high when it's that hot. So it's not that we were sitting there, you know, but a few, you have a few beers and, you know, you felt, and we did have to go out and up, we had to move that night.
Mm-hmm.
It was like very quick, and this one Army platoon we were carrying, we had carried them before, and I was very friendly with one of the Army sergeants, and this was, turned out to be one of the closest time we might have had an Army-Navy incident. As I said earlier, there were times I didn't get along with my boat captain.
Right.
And one of the things we as a collective crew weren't too crazy about our boat captain is, you know, he wasn't exactly a John Wayne, to say the least. And we were going down this river, and, you know, in very few places in the United States do you see like it is over there when there's no lights anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Pitch black. And it was one of these moonless, pitch black nights. And somebody in some helicopter saw some unexplained lights, and they wanted us to drop the troops off in the middle of nowhere and have them investigate it. So, like I said, I was in the front of the boat. We had operated with these guys before, so I was on a first-name basis with quite a few of them. Don't ask me their names now, because I never remember.
Okay.
And from the minute we dropped the ramp, my boat captain was fearful. I'm not going to say he was afraid or scared or, you know, but just too quick to tell them to get off the boat. Mm-hmm. He come down a couple times and told me to hurry those guys off. I want to get out of here. And you can't, you know, unless you've been there, see what these guys stepped off into. I was so glad I wasn't going anywhere off the boat. And so I think it was part of the thing that my boat captain had too many to drink because he was an alcoholic.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I used to like to drink, but from when I met him in California, I mean, you know, he was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying he didn't function, but he drank all the time. Mm-hmm. So he's telling us to get off the boat, and of course the sergeant is arguing with him. You know, I'm not going to get off fast. You know, I'm going to do this, and he starts screaming at the sergeant that if you guys don't get off the boat in 5 minutes, I'm going to raise the ramp. And the sergeant says, you try to raise the ramp, I'm going to blow your head off. Mm-hmm. So I jumped into the hunt and started screaming at my boat captain, you know, leave them alone. They'll get off the boat. And if you try to raise the ramp on them, I'll kick the goddamn belt off. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're having a big row. You know, and he starts screaming at me, there goes my promotion. Mm-hmm. And I told him I don't give a flying about my promotion. And so they got off the boat very, you know. Mm-hmm. They took their time because they were stepping off into a hostile area that you couldn't see 3 feet in front of you.
Right.
So then the next day, well, that during that exchange, my boat captain told me that that's it. You know, he's going to put me on support report for insubordination.
Okay.
And by then I told him, I don't care, mm-hmm. you know, because these guys were my friends, and I was not going to let them, you know, rush off into a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, my boat captain doesn't say anything to me, but all of a sudden the sergeant shows up with his lieutenant.
The sergeant, the Army sergeant?
The Army sergeant, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Shows up with his lieutenant, company lieutenant, and we have a nice little powwow. He asked me what happened, and I explained it to him, and he says, okay, that's exactly what the sergeant told me. And he said to me that the, because the sergeant heard the boat captain tell me he was going to, you know, write me up, and he said that he'd follow up on that. And I said, at this time, I haven't heard anything. And the lieutenant says, okay, don't worry about a thing. I've already discussed it with the captain, and if you're brought up on charges, we will be there to defend you. I said, thank you very much. No problem. And my boat captain heard part of this exchange, and nothing was said from that point. But he was the nicest to me, you know, for 2 or 3 days. It was like, you know, there's nothing he wouldn't do for me. But that was the only time that there was ever an incident that I saw anybody drinking while we were, you know, on anything related to an operation. But that was circumstance.
And that was your boat captain.
Yeah. Oh, we were probably feeling no pain also because
right.
we had been, you know. I said, not that we were drunk, but, you know, even after just having, you know, 3 or 4 beers across, you know, you got hit very easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was when drinking with a lot of those guys, and, you know, we were young and, you know, regular drinkers in those days, so I knew how much we could put down, and I saw the same guys get tipsy on 2 or 3 beers, and I used to see them, you know, sit and have a lot more, but it's the climate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I saw no incidents of drug abuse and, you know, during the time that they were in the field.
Right. Okay.
It was always in a down status.
Uh-huh.
But very few. There's only a couple. Most of it was just the drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we did tie a few on. I'm not saying we never did that, but
of course.
You know, we weren't going to go anywhere for a day or two.
Right. Right. What other things would you do for entertainment? Did you go to USO shows?
Yeah, they had a few of them. Just local, you know, Filipino groups and whatnot. I missed the Bob Hope show.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up, and My boat captain made sure I didn't go.
Was this at Dong Tam or at...
Yeah, it's at Dong Tam, right.
Okay.
My sister was in the hospital with having one of her children. When she watched the show, and of course she screamed everybody around it. My brother's there. Because she knew I was in Dong Tam.
Right.
But, because Bob Hope said, you know, he wants to, you know, say a good hello to all the river rats out there from Dong Tam. But
uh-huh.
I didn't see it. I was on the boat.
Your captain wouldn't let you off?
No. He pulled regulations. The regulation said that you had to have a 3-man crew on board at all times.
Mm-hmm.
So between the two river divisions, 111 and 112, you're talking about over 50 boats. 49 of those boats, they kept 2 men on, because you could get by with 2 men.
Mm-hmm.
One to drive the boat, one to tie it, and one tie it.
Mm-hmm.
My boat had 3 men on it. I mean, I legitimately, we drew straws,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't win,
mm-hmm.
but two of the guys, one guy, my friend Adam, said, you know, look, I saw Bob Hope 3 times in college. I know how much you want to go, and the other guy said he doesn't want to go no matter what. They volunteered to stay on board the boat, and even they all asked the boat captain to let me go.
Right.
But he insisted, no, the regulations say you have to have 3 men on board. But it's because we didn't get along.
Sounds like you and the other guys had a kind of an adversarial relationship with this guy.
Yeah, he wasn't, I don't know how you can describe it. You know, he was thrown into a position of command, and not everybody is good at commanding. You know, and he just did not how to handle people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a couple times, one time in particular, he come on back on board the boat after he was on the ship with his friends drinking and was in a cantankerous mood. And, of course, he picks the smallest guy in the boat and starts to pick a fight with him, you know, like he's going to be a bad guy. So, but I jumped out off my rack and stuck my nose in the boat captain's face and said, if you're going to hit anybody on board this boat, you know, so we had a few rows like that.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you know, those, even though we thought he was a jerk, we still got along most of the time,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Tell me what your impression was of the Vietnamese Navy. You mentioned turning the boats over to the Vietnamese Navy, and this, I guess, was the starting of the process of Vietnamization, turning the war over
yeah.
to the Vietnamese. What did you think they were, first of all, competent to handle their duties on the rivers and in the oceans?
Not what we saw. I mean, as you know, enough of them didn't look like they had the mechanical skills to know how to operate the engines properly and... No, so I don't think there was anywhere near as trained as we were
mm-hmm.
in how, you know, to handle the boats.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't see too much. We only periodically saw a couple of them
mm-hmm.
come on board the boats. But I do remember one time one of the Vietnamese Navy guys was riding with us, and the Army had one of those Chu Hoi scouts, whatever mm-hmm. how you pronounce it.
Chu Hoi, that's right.
Chu Hoi, and we didn't think nothing of it, and we... said, why don't you go talk to him? You can finally talk to somebody in Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at us and shook his head with this look of hatred on his face and said, number 10, you know,
mm-hmm.
VC, VC. Because mm-hmm. they all were, you know, ex, you know, Viet Cong who
right.
came over to ours, the so-called American side. So he wanted nothing to do with them.
Right.
That's one of the things I do remember. As much as, you know, they were supposedly very good in the field with helping some of the Army guys in situations, this Vietnamese Navy guy wanted nothing to do with him.
Hmm.
But, you know, the other parts were, like I said, I just heard other stories of the guys who had more contact with him, that they were just not that competent for taking care of the boats.
What did you think of the American policy of Vietnamization in general?
In general, it was the right idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but just... I don't know, how do you say, I'm not saying it wasn't able to be done, but it was just too big a job, too big a task,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Army was a lot of draftees on their side, so, you know, they weren't as hot to fight. The Vietnamese Marines were, they were something else, though. They were more than willing to fight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a good idea, but, you know, I think just based on... you know, all of the things I've read and you know, heard about it, it's true. That we didn't understand their culture, so it's very hard for us to come in and teach them things that, you know, just most of the world doesn't do the things the same way we do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it was a good idea, but it just didn't fly right.
What did you think of Vietnam itself, the country?
Beautiful country. I mean, I thought when I got a chance to go to Saigon a couple of times, I'd love to have seen Saigon before the war. I mean, it had to be an exciting place to be.
Mm-hmm.
The people were just, you know, very nice, and the women were very pretty,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it was a very picturesque country. That's too bad it was so dilapidated by a war.
Mm-hmm. What was the bravest action that you witnessed in Vietnam?
The bravest action?
Yes, sir.
Being that I really didn't see anything out of the ordinary.
Okay.
You know, because, like I said, I was never on the boat when it got hit.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see anybody do anything extraordinary. Just a normal day-to-day, you know, doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall a humorous event that stands out in your mind?
Humorous event. Okay. We were going down one of the various rivers, and it was a free fire zone.
Mm-hmm.
So unless, even just going down the rivers, it was always two men had the duty. You know, 12 to 4, 4 to 8, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you were doing something specific, like you know, if the engine was broken and we were doing some maintenance, you didn't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I laid in my rack.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, like, dozing, sleeping. And unknown to me, one of the boats behind us wanted to test his 20. You know, they were working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided not to tell me that they were going to test fire the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm laying in my rack, and all of a sudden I hear the 20 going off, and I think we're under attack.
Mm-hmm.
So I leap out of my bunk, and my bunk was way up near the front of the boat, like not that far from my gun rack.
Mm-hmm.
So in almost like one motion as I landed on the deck, I grabbed my helmet, put it on, put my flak jacket on, and threw around in the chamber, and I was getting ready to shoot.
Right.
And then the corner of my eye, I catch and I hear the laughter of about three or four guys in the back of the boat.
Uh-huh.
They're laughing their asses off. And then I got it, you know. And they said, Mac, you should have seen yourself. It looked like you almost levitated out of the bunk, you know. And it's like they thought that was the funniest thing.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then the other thing, it wasn't, you know, as funny, but I got drunk one day and took a nap, or passed out, whichever way you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
in one of the dried-out rice paddies. And the guy told me he took the picture, you know, spread eagle. We wore nothing but shorts, so it was half, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, oh, you should have seen this great picture I took. I said, well, where is it? Well, I sent it home to my mother.
Oh,
so that's one I would like to have seen.
Uh-huh.
But that was the funny.
Did you ever encounter any wild animals or anything unusual? Any unusual wildlife on the river?
Just seen snakes in the water. That's about it.
Yeah? What kind of snakes did you know?
Just big snakes. And rats.
Yeah?
Rats. There was rats on the ship. That was some of the other kind of funny incident. You've seen the pictures of the ships with the pontoons tied up to them?
Yes, sir.
And then the boats were tied up to the pontoons.
Yes.
Every once in a while, some rat would be scurrying from the ship,
mm-hmm.
and make the pontoon. Now it's scurrying up and down the pontoon trying to get on the boats. And everybody on the boat's got every stick, the broom, or something that they can get, trying to whack at this rat so it doesn't come on our boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was like a Keystone Cop routine with this rat running up and down the pontoon, you know, with the guys on the pontoon trying to stomp on it, the guys on the boat trying to beat at it so it doesn't jump on the boats,
uh-huh.
and then it eventually diving in the water.
Well, did y'all have any pets?
No, we didn't have pets.
As your dog chimes in.
Yeah.
Background. Perfect timing. You said you formed some relationships there with the men with whom you served. You mentioned Adam a few times. Did you?
Uh-huh.
Have you kept contact with him? Or?
I've talked to him a few times and met him at a couple of reunions.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't talked to him. We were in River Warfare School together. We went to Vietnam together.
Uh-huh.
And we were in C School. We went to Charleston, South Carolina for Engineman C School.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw him after I got back from Vietnam.
Okay.
And so that was 69,
mm-hmm.
you know, September 69. I didn't talk to him till the summer of 87.
Wow.
I was going down to Washington. They had a concert down in Washington, Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Concert.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister, who's very lucky at these things, won a contest from a radio show in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to run bus trips down there. And I've always been very bad with names.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't remember the name of the guy who was killed on my riverboat. I knew his name was Whitey. We called him because he had platinum blonde hair. His name was Donald. And I called Adam. You know, he's the only guy I could... whatever name, I remember his name. Adam Carl Metz III. So he was one of the few names I remembered besides Matthew J. Nutt. Those are the only two guys whose names I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew he lived in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
So I called the... one day I just got on work and called the Dallas information and said, look, I'm trying to locate a guy. I don't know where he lives. I knew he used to live in the area. Sure, it's not a common name, and I'm, you know, I haven't talked to him since I got home from Vietnam. And I got his father's number,
mm-hmm.
and so we talked. He couldn't remember his last name either.
So
when I finally, you know, this is, you know, before the PCs with the lookups and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
in 87, they just had the book there,
mm-hmm.
and it was on July 4th, and I'm, now he thought it was something like Brick House or Burke House, and I'm trying to go through this, and there's like people waiting behind me, and I never got to see his name on the wall the first time I went.
Mm-hmm.
But I subsequently, through one of those moving walls they have,
yes, sir.
Where they had the PC,
mm-hmm.
his name was Donald Bruckett.
Okay.
So I was able then to finally locate it. And it was like a tremendous feeling of relief. I was finally able to, you know, see his name on the wall,
mm-hmm.
even if it was the moving wall.
Right, right. What was your experience like at the wall in Washington?
Well, I was so stoned.
Oh, yeah?
Going down, you know, I went with my sister, and some guys in the back of the bus lit up, and she goes, go ahead. But it was very, you know... I remember just coming upon it, and it was very stirring. It was just, you know, just so awestruck by it the first time I saw it. You know, it was very rewarding to, you know, get to finally have gotten there. Even though I didn't find his name, there was plenty of other names on the wall to see.
Have
it was a great concert, too, besides, by the way.
Who was playing?
Oh, Neil Diamond started the show. They had Frankie Valli, the Four Tops,
mm-hmm.
Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
Mm-hmm.
What's her name? A couple of female singers who their names escape me right now. Stevie Wonder, James Brown.
Wow. Wow.
John Fogerty, who played Creedence song for the first time live on stage
uh-huh.
in 14 years for
okay.
that concert.
I actually I know this concert. When you just said that, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, if you saw the concert on HBO, then you saw my sister and I because we were in the sixth row, and so
uh-huh.
we were there a couple times. The only person who I didn't sit through the concert when he came out on stage, I walked out, was Chris Christopherson.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember reading about the incident where he was presented a plaque.
Mm-hmm.
He performed in some concert in the Buffalo area, and the local Vietnam Veterans Group gave him a plaque,
mm-hmm.
and they found it in the garbage the next day,
mm.
you know, in the dressing room. Of course, you know, his people said it was a mistake. He didn't mean to throw it away, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, I didn't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't buy it for two reasons. I didn't buy it because I don't believe he, because I believe he's a big liberal. And the other thing was, I'm a great believer, and I don't have to believe everything you say, mm-hmm. but I would have respected the man more if he came on stage and said something to us, you know, face to face, not sending his three flunkies out to explain what happened and to give his side of it. So that's the only part of the concert I didn't see. Even when I watch it on tape, I don't watch that part.
Okay.
But it was very interesting to be down in Washington on July 4th. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
What was your experience at the Moving Wall like? Where did you see it?
I saw the Moving Wall in Kingston.
Okay.
Same thing. It had the same impact, but more so because I was able to finally locate the names of Donald and Harry, the guy who was killed on the Westchester County, was one of my very good friends. And it was, how do I put it? It was a form of, you get to a certain age, your mind just starts to wander. It was just a feeling of just relief that I was able to find them. Fulfillment, you know, of a certain amount of closure that I could touch their names. I also got involved with a Vietnam veterans chapter that brought the Moving Wall to our area here.
Okay.
And that was a tremendous experience. I touched every name on the wall.
Did you really?
Yeah. Well, you know, we had to wipe down the wall every night in the morning when it got, you know, the morning mist. And I went out there the first morning to do it, and I'm wiping all the names, all of a sudden it hit me. You know, I'm touching every name by wiping the wall down.
Mm-hmm.
So I just never stopped. I went through the whole thing.
Hmm.
It was so great to see a couple of the Gold Star mothers. One of them used to come to the meetings, and the woman was beaming. She just said to us, "You guys don't know how happy you're making me that you're not forgetting my son. And I feel as long as you guys are around, my son will never be forgotten."
Mm-hmm.
And that just hit me so hard that, you know, that's how they feel. And, you know, the passage of time doesn't change that for them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other families, one of the mothers never went to the wall in Washington, came to this one.
Mm-hmm.
And his sister, you know, we had to have 24-hour coverage on the walls. So on a Thursday night after everybody left and was gone, and, you know, we're sitting around having a couple quiet beers, and she came over to all of us and gave us all hugs and kisses and said, you know, "This past week you've made my brother alive again."
Hmm.
So those are the memories I carry about, you know, the respect for their loss, and the feeling is why I get involved in things like this, and, you know, always have my hats on and, you know, my shirts and things like that. And I don't want anybody to forget that, you know, the sacrifice that these families had to put through.
Yes, sir.
And I did meet another Gold Star mother there. Like I said to you earlier, you know, I'll say a lot of things to people, but you know, I met this woman at the wall, and, you know, I stayed at the wall. I mean, they had the politician speeches and all of that. I stayed at the wall. I wanted to be there helping people.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm, you know, trying to comfort this one woman. "Are you all right?" She says, "Yeah." And I said, "Was it somebody you knew?" You know, I'm expecting, like, you know, a cousin or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "Yes, he was my son."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then she started in, you know, like, why did this have to happen? You know, why did he have to die in that terrible war to accomplish nothing? And, you know, it's nothing you can say to them.
No.
But, you know, the best story about the war, a former Marine comes up to me and says, "You know, I looked up in my company boot camp yearbook, you know, all of the guys I went to boot camp with and eventually went to Vietnam, and I've got these 10 guys that I haven't heard from. I don't know if any of them made it on the wall. You know, can we look?" And so I'm going through name by name, because I had one of the books, and, you know, his eyes are just brightening up, and we didn't find one of his 10 names on the wall.
Wow.
And that was very good, because, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. But the Moving Wall was also, you know, besides the normal, my wife thought that somebody she knew from school you know, was killed over there and never knew for sure. Mm-hmm. And then she was able to, unfortunately for her, find out that he was. And mm-hmm. But for the most part, it was very, I don't necessarily would not want to go through, you know, the preparation that we had to put in, the months of work to get it there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was an experience I wouldn't want to have changed if we did it.
Tell me how you felt when you left Vietnam in 1969.
What's the level of ecstasy and ecstatic? It was, but like the good thing was, is I did get almost a month, or a month and a half, of being off the river. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wasn't as, you know, drastic as going from, you know, the frontline unit mm-hmm. back to home, but. I hadn't been home in 15 months, you know, I hadn't seen my family, and I just couldn't wait to get out of there.
Do you remember the plane flight back?
Oh, do I ever. I remember the feeling of such, when I saw the Golden Gate, well, I take that back. We didn't see the Golden Gate Bridge, we saw the cloud cover, because uh-huh. we landed in Oakland first. They never let us off the plane, which is something I've never been on before, that they refueled a plane with us on it. Mm-hmm. So I guess most of the guys wouldn't have gotten back on. And then I got we flew to not Clark, one of the Air Force bases down there, Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And now I'm ready for the typical hurry up and wait. Mm-hmm. You know, how it's going to take hours and hours to process the 166 guys on the plane. Mm-hmm. And it took 25 minutes.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe they, you know. Mm-hmm. See, the thing with this, I wasn't supposed to have been on that plane. I actually got a chance to go home early. Mm-hmm. When you got your flight date, they always gave you the date approximately a month in advance. Mm-hmm. Anytime before that month, if there was an open seat and you got all your papers signed and your division commander authorized that you were able to go home. Mm-hmm. Now, I had just gotten back from R&R, no more than a few. I don't remember the exact number, but it couldn't have been more than 3 or 4 days. Mm-hmm. You know, because I still had that feeling of euphoria. You know, I was standing in the machine shop working on an engine, and a friend of mine comes in. He comes running in, and he has these papers, and he whacks me in the back of the head. And I'm getting ready to turn around and curse him out, and he's just got this look on his face, and he goes, Mac, get your ass up to flight control. They've got 100 open seats going home the day after tomorrow.
Oh my God.
I'm on it, he told me. And it was like, are you kidding? And I just got my papers, and so I didn't even have a chance to think about being short. You know, I went from having almost 3.5 weeks left to on the plane 2 days later, and
wow.
It was just. Wow. I still have this picture that I took, actually, because I didn't leave the day I was supposed to. It had some delay, and we left the second day. Mm-hmm. And I've got this look on my face like I'm just lost my puppy with, you know. So I'm sitting in my dress blues because I had nothing else to wear. Uh-huh. I lost my sea bag over there. My sea bag took a trip to Japan.
Oh, really?
When I came back from R&R, the first time the River Division had moved, and I had said that we had lockers on board the ships.
Uh-huh.
So we kept most of our stuff there, you know, like the whites and things I wasn't going to use. Don't ask me why I had my dress blues on board the boat. But my River Division had gone up north towards the Cambodian area there.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't think nothing of it. I hitched a ride on one of the other boats going up there one day, and by the time we got back, I said, "No, where's the ship?"
Mm-hmm.
And then all the other guys in the boat says, "Oh, they were going to Japan. Didn't anybody tell you?" I said, "No." I said, "Did you guys get my stuff out of my locker?" They goes, "No." So my sea bag went to Japan. Mm-hmm. So I had no whites to wear at home. I had these dress blues. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sitting in this rec area in Da Nang, like, why am I on my way home?
Yeah.
But I made it. The flight was great. I get to L.A. Airport. One of the guys on the plane I was talking to lived in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and he had less flights. So he had a flight at 3 o'clock, so I put myself on a flight at 2:30 because I figured we'd go to the bar first.
Mm-hmm.
We just couldn't wait to get a Tom Collins, you know.
Uh-huh.
Went to the bar in Los Angeles Airport, and ordered a Tom Collins. The guy put it in front of us, and before he turned around with the money to ring it up, we had finished the drinks, so we're asking for another one. So I wasn't feeling much pain by the time I got on board the plane.
Uh-huh.
And then another guy comes back from first class and says, "Were you on that plane from Da Nang?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I thought I recognized you from the plane. Come on up to first class with me. I got a couple bottles of champagne." They wouldn't let me go up there, but he came back and sat with me, and so we polished off two bottles of champagne. So by then we were just like, you know, they started the movie, and I said, "Oh, this looks like a good..." I fell asleep.
Uh-huh.
Next thing I know, you know, fasten your seatbelts, we're landing in Kennedy Airport. I had always wanted to surprise my mom.
Uh-huh.
I never told her I was coming home. And I just wanted to show up at her door.
Uh-huh.
And so it's 2:30 Los Angeles time, which made it 5:30 back here in New York.
Uh-huh.
You know, 6-hour flight.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to get to the airport 11, 12 o'clock at night and not have a car to rent.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to rent a car. So the girl says, "No problem. I just need a credit card to, you know, to pay for it." I said, "I want to pay cash." She said, "No, I'm sorry. You can only pay cash when you're there, but to reserve a car, you need a credit card." So I said, "Look at me, sweetheart. I just got back from Vietnam. Well, they think I got a credit card on me?" And, I, you know, you can't be mad at the girl for the policy. She says, "I'm sorry. There's nothing I can do. You know, best you can do is when you get there." So I said, "No, you know, I don't need the hassle." So I called home,
yeah,
and I got my sister. And she goes, "What's the matter?" I said, "Nothing's the matter." She said, "Where are you?" "I'm in Los Angeles Airport. I'm coming home."
Mm-hmm.
So she started screaming, you know, and, what flight are you on? What airline? So I said, "I'm on TWA flight 729. As God's my witness, she goes, "How do you spell that?" So that's another memory. Will never, to the day I die, I remember that look on my mother's face when I saw her.
She at the airport to meet you?
Yeah. She come around. I was walking, and I saw her come around the corner, and I couldn't move.
Mm-hmm.
Watching this little old lady run as fast as Jesse Owens.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a feeling to get home.
Yeah.
Finally, all of the dreams came true. I used to have a recurring dream in Vietnam about being home. They weren't sad dreams. In fact, they were rather quite happy because I was home, you know, partying with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of the dreams, it was always, "Why, you know, are you home for good?"
Mm-hmm.
And I would say no. I would say, "I have to go back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when I have to go back, but I know I have to go back." And I didn't even know why I was home.
Right.
I just knew I was home. And, you know, hold on a second. So I finally, you know, got home and had another month's leave and had a great time. I stayed drunk for 29 or 30 days.
How did you transition back to the United States? Was it difficult for you?
Not really, because being I was in the Navy and I actually got, I wasn't even in the Navy 2 years by the time I got back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two more years of my enlistment to go.
Right.
So being in my hometown wasn't too bad because I didn't get bothered that much, but I went back to California and, you know, was more or less in a, you know, a military environment again, stationed in, you know, Long Beach, California.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So it wasn't a really severe transition for you?
No. I mean, I had a few incidents. Like, I mean, thankfully I was never spit on, but you know, I was called baby burner a few times by, you know, a few idiot kids, but, you know, it was never anything severe.
Did you discuss your Vietnam experience with anybody? Did anybody ask you about it?
Nobody asked. I mean, I did discuss with a few people. In fact, I never got to finish the other part of the big firefight story with the that small army base.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm sitting in a bar at Dunwoody Tavern. I always remember the name. And I saw a guy there that I hadn't seen since we went to grade school together.
Mm-hmm.
So we lost contact, at, you know, in high school. And it's like, "Kevin, how's it going?" "Yeah, no problem. What have you been doing?" He goes, "Man, I just got back from Vietnam." I said, "Yeah, so did I." He goes, "Who were you with?" He said, "You know, Big Red One. I said, oh, yeah, I heard of them. I was with the Mobile Marine Force. Mm-hmm. He goes, is that those little gunboat things? I said, yeah. He says, man, I remember one night we were in this one little fire support base in the middle of nowhere, and Charlie hit us that night, and these two Navy boats were there. And, boy, you should have seen it when when the Navy boats opened up on them. He was on that base.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was like, you know, my jaw hit the ground, like, are you kidding me?
Uh-huh.
So we had a good old time.
That's so. Wow. How much did you keep up with American policy and what was happening in Vietnam once you got back to the States?
I went into a shell.
Yeah.
I mean, the big things, yeah. But, you know, one of my minor, major, whatever you want to call it, regrets in life,
mm-hmm.
I never knew they had those MIA bracelets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, where'd they come from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I maybe part of it was because of still being in the military for 2 years. I don't know. It's just, I knew what was going on, but, you know, just went into a shell.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until, not that I never talked about it, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, the feelings of what we went through and the anxieties, it wasn't until, what was it, when the hostages came back from Iran,
mm-hmm.
80, whatever that was.
1980, yes.
I worked in Manhattan then also,
mm-hmm.
and they were going to have the big parade for them up Wall Street, and I was like a half a block around the corner, and I remember the day getting excited like everybody else, you know. Even before the parade started, we were throwing things out the window, you know,
mm-hmm.
computer papers and having a good old time. And then 12 o'clock rolls around and the whole office emptied out and I sat at my desk.
Why?
I don't know.
Could you somehow relate that, the hostages coming back to your Vietnam experience? And
The experience of the way we were treated,
mm-hmm.
you know, I didn't expect parades when we came home, but, you know, the whole prevailing attitude of the nation back then was, you know, we were wrong, we were baby killers,
mm-hmm.
we lost the war, we were drug addicts, you know, we were bums,
mm-hmm.
you know, I almost got into a big fight, you know, the closest I ever came to really hitting someone in an office environment
mm-hmm.
when some guy who never served in the military, you know, my age, for whatever reason he didn't go,
mm-hmm.
started telling all of the, you know, we were having a discussion on it, because it's mostly a male environment, all the other guys, how lousy the fighters were in Vietnam compared to the other wars. And it's like, you know, I just got insane. I said, how dare you? How dare you make a comment on something you know nothing about?
Right.
You know, so it was just like, I just sat at my desk, and people asked me, am I going? And I said, no. Why? I don't know. I just don't feel like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I could watch the news that night, and the comment came about. A lot of Vietnam vets did not want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Read about it in the paper the next day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then a lot of things changed. You know, you start looking at the experiences from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Have you ever suffered from any PTSD symptoms?
No. I was blessed 3 times. I survived. I was never wounded. And, I mean, we all Vietnam vets suffer from some parts of anxiety, but
mm-hmm.
never to the point of, you know. In fact, I was talking about that with one of the guys in my Vietnam veterans chapter just the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it is, because he says, well, do you think you'll ever, you know, be affected by it later on in life, like maybe when you retire? And I said, I don't think so. I was in combat, but I never had any of the experiences of the boat being hit and the, you know,
mm-hmm.
I saw a few dead bodies over there, but it was never that close to any of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just don't think I'll ever, not that I don't get, you know, blue about it or, you know, the old survival guilt, things like that. But I've never, in the long run, I think it's made me a better person serving in Vietnam.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think that stronger, able to handle more things, you know, loyalty end of it from the military. You know, we were taught loyalty, and I carry that over to my civilian life. I expect loyalty in my bosses, mm-hmm. you know, because if people want loyalty then, people are going to die, and, you know, so I think it's made me a stronger person. Mm-hmm. You know.
Would you say that was the most significant thing you learned there?
Probably, and just the idea of, you know, life is very short normally, you know, and then when you realize how short it is when you're 20 years old, and, you know, I've developed a very good attitude about life and living in general. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to enjoy it mm-hmm. because it's too easy to be taken away from you.
Is there anything that you would change about your experience in Vietnam if you could?
Well, I definitely don't want to say I wanted to be wounded or anything, but... no, I don't think so.
Okay. Do you remember how you felt April 1975 when South Vietnam fell?
I felt, what a waste. You know, everything we tried to accomplish, all of the, you know, all of the lives that were lost on both sides, and, you know, we just walked away with our tails between our legs. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing was we abandoned them. You know, we promised them that we would train them, we would support them, and in their greatest hour of need, we ignored them. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very very down on just the way the people who were running the country.
Do you think the United States learned any lessons from the war?
From a military point of view, I think they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, during the Gulf War, I don't remember the name of the book. There was a book that was mostly about the Schwarzkopf's and Colin Powell's and quite a few of the Marine generals who had served as lieutenants and captains during Vietnam that just told President Bush and the Joint Chiefs of Staff that if they pulled the same crap on them and their men that they did in Vietnam, and without supporting them and having a specific goal, that they would resign their commissions and would not tolerate it. Mm-hmm. I think the military, and somewhat, you know, basically because of the Ronald Reagan years where mm-hmm. you know, we changed our attitudes, I think the American government has this, for the most part, that you have to go to war with a specific purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, not a war of attrition like they did there, not saying, well, we'll keep doing this, and you know, you have to have a set goal, and I think, honestly, I hope we've learned it, because, you know, too many men's lives were lost because we didn't have a clear path, mm-hmm. and we hope we learned that we can't fight a war, that you just don't fight it. I mean, if I can believe some of the things I've read that are coming out of some of the analysis by some of the North Vietnamese, mm-hmm. you know, today, that they were very close to capitulating if we had kept up the attacks and started bombing the North more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can't fight a war when you don't go after them. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did in Vietnam.
Do you think the United States should have invaded on the ground North Vietnam?
If they really wanted to finish the war, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, but it was all political. They were so afraid of the Chinese entering the war like they did in Korea, mm-hmm. you know, that they didn't try to win it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what I resented the most about how they did it. You know, not to, like I said, I believe we belong to be there, but don't fight a war for 8 years with no real attempt to win it.
Right.
You know, don't fight a war with, you know, don't handcuff the military. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to be there to win, and just don't bother.
What would you tell young people today about the Vietnam War if you had a chance to talk to them?
Well, I would tell them that what we did there was necessary. And the first reunion I went to was in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I forget the year, but Admiral Zumwalt was one of the guest speakers. Mm-hmm. And besides the fact it was my first and it was very emotional, he gave a speech that for the first time as a Vietnam veteran, I felt good about what we did. Because he said when he left Saigon in 75 before the fall, he stopped off at, I think he said, Singapore, one of those countries in Indonesia. It was very hard to remember. It was very, very emotional, you know. And he said he was having supper with the president of the country. And the president told him, I know you and the rest of America feels very bad right now about Saigon falling. And he said to the admiral, I know right now you think that you accomplished nothing over there and all, everything that you, the Americans you lost accomplished nothing. But he said, it's not true. What you accomplished is you bought time for my country, Thailand, other countries of Southeast Asia, that we were able to build ourselves up economically, that we're not susceptible to the type of revolution that hit Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And for that, I want to thank you and all of the Americans who gave their lives and fought there. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I would tell the young people. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing is in the world today a single event. Everything has a ripple effect, and everything that's done is done with more than just, you know, the singleness of the United States and Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I've read some books further about, you know, the commitment that we made. You know, we did make a commitment to the South Vietnamese that some of these other countries that we were trying to help and were being bombarded from the communist side, if we just pulled out and left Vietnam, what are we going to tell these people when we tell them, oh, you know, do this and do that and come out democracy? We'll support you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's the ally type thing that, you know, you have to support your allies, and everything has a ripple effect. Nothing is so singular that it's unaffected by the other events in the world. And that's what I would tell them. And the other thing I would tell them of the gallantry of the American fighting force over there, I thought that we were soldiers, and Colonel Moore, I mean, I thought he did a spectacular job of, you know, it's an old cliche, but when the bullets are firing at you, there's no right or wrong. There's just you and the guy next to you trying to survive. And, you know, that's what I try to impart to them, you know, that it's a game of survival, you know.
Did you feel like you fought more for your buddies on that boat when you're in a firefight versus for American policy? Or?
Well, I guess the best way I can say is the night that I was sitting on that radio watch, and everything that's logical says I should have been happy that I was there and not being fired upon, I will go to my grave regretting I was with them. So it's definitely you fight for them. Which is, I think, why a lot of guys will go back. You know, a lot of guys went over there for more than one tour. I think that's the reason. But, you know.
Have you experienced the so-called survivor guilt?
A lot of times. You know, nothing... yes, I mean, that's the best way of putting it. Yes, I have. You know, I'll read some books about it or just anything, and just, you know, sometimes it's never overwhelming. It's just, you know, feeling a depression at times, but not enough that it's ever bothered me more than just the anxiety of the moment. But yeah, I felt it.
You said you've read some books on Vietnam. Tell me what you've read or what you think are really worthy books written about the war.
Well, We Were Soldiers is probably one of the better ones. And you know, I read so many books, it's very hard for me to remember the title.
Right.
You know, there was a book, Combat Infantrymen, and there was another book, it was just called 68-69. I read constantly. You know, and there are a lot of times I read two books at a time, so that the titles just, you know, blur after a while.
How about movies on Vietnam. Do you go see them?
Yes, I've seen most of them. I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Deer Hunter was a joke.
Really?
Had nothing to do with Vietnam as much as the impact of Vietnam on people.
Mm-hmm.
Apocalypse Now was one of my favorite all-time movies.
Mm-hmm.
As a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Also was crap. Had nothing to do with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, from a military point of view, they would never have done what they did there.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like Platoon. I thought that, and what's his name? Is it the maker of the movie?
Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone is not one of my favorite people, but
mm-hmm.
I thought he did a good job in Platoon about showing both sides of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really have to watch it, you know, like the Charlie Sheen character.
Mm-hmm.
If you really look at it, it captured a little bit about what could happen in the environment of ambushes and booby traps, and you know, you have to really understand that the Viet Cong were trying to get the Americans to do some of the things they did,
mm-hmm.
and also how it's very easy to be the other insane guys, you know, just to go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We Were Soldiers, spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that that was by far the best.
Okay.
Hadley Hilton was another tremendous movie. Hamburger Hill was good. I thought Full Metal Jacket was crap.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's just my opinion.
That's what we're after.
Yeah.
Any songs that you listen to on the radio take you back to Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. Stone Satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Girl Watcher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's his name? Neil Diamond's Cherry Cherry, a lot of the songs.
Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
Just a couple times down in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I was down in Washington in the year 2000, Veterans Day.
Mm-hmm.
I met a few of them. And I've met some Vietnam nationals in Las Vegas and Reno. And one of them was actually from Mito, which is right down the block from Dong Tam.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very interesting people.
Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam?
I don't know. If I did go back, I'd like to go back with a group of guys that, you know, served over there in the same. Probably yes, if the circumstances were right.
What are your thoughts on Vietnam today, the country itself?
Well, overall, I'm a capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
If we can create American jobs by trading with them, why not?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, some of our biggest allies today are Japan and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened in those wars were no worse than ours. I don't feel that any Vietnam veteran who can't stand the Vietnamese or anything to do with them, that they're wrong, you know, but I just don't feel that way. I think the people were, that people are not the government, and just like here, and if the government is corrupt, and I don't always blame the people,
mm-hmm.
but from what I've read in some of the magazines or some of the shows I've seen on television, they're very hard-working, industrious people. And from some of the people who have known Vietnam veterans have gone back, that they don't show any animosity towards us for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And God, if anybody should feel animosity, it's them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't even know how many of them we killed. You know, never mind, you know, their MIAs. So, I mean, I think the past is the past, and we can go on. You know, so.
Well, sir, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation tonight?
Not at this time.
Okay. All right, we'll go ahead and end the interview. Thank you, sir.
Okay.